Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Let me ask you guys a question. How many of you think you're going to work in the field of healthcare in some fashion? Okay, good. Many of you. Well, I want to talk about a controversy that has drawn a lot of my attention, and that has been a controversy over medical practitioners and physicians in particular refusing patients' requests for certain morally contested interventions, such as abortion, physician-assisted suicide, or the one probably most pressing today, the surgical modification or even hormonal modification of secondary sex characteristics. It's kind of called gender affirmation. When physicians refuse such interventions, many now argue they're basically letting their personal values interfere with their professional obligations. An essay in the New England Journal of Medicine by Ronit Stahl and Ezekiel Emanuel in 2017 illustrates the point. They assert that patients have a right to choose the healthcare services they need for their own well-being. And physicians have a corollary obligation to accommodate the patient's choices, either by providing the requested intervention or by referring the patient to someone who will. And it seems to me there's something right about this. After all, as Stahl and Emanuel put it, physicians are not conscripts. You're not drafted into the medical profession. No one's compelled to become a physician. And in becoming a physician, one willingly takes on responsibilities that go with the role, this office, if you will, being a physician. Surely the public and the profession can hold physicians to fulfill their professional responsibilities, or as Stahl and Emanuel put it, their role morality. We would not countenance teachers who refuse to grade their students' work, or attorneys who refuse to represent their clients before the justice system. We wouldn't allow that. So why then would we allow physicians to refuse what patients request? Something right about that. Yet, the boundaries of what we accept and what we reject, where professional refusals are concerned, clearly centers on answers to the following questions. What is this profession for? What are those obligations that come with one's profession? You might say that come with deciding to take on this role. What are the obligations that come with that decision? Teachers are allowed and even expected to refuse some of their students' requests. My guess is those of you in here, many of you have made a request to a teacher that was denied. And the same is true for lawyers with their clients. So there's some things that can be refused. The same thing must be true for medicine. Yet medicine is in the grip, Professor Tolleson and I argue in our book, it's in the grip of two radically different ways of answering these questions. And debates about conscientious refusals indicate the profession of medicine can't continue indefinitely with these two contradictory construals of its purpose, what medicine is for. So for those of you going into the health professions, I will just say, if we're right, and I'm pretty sure we're right on the core things that we're observing, you're going to find a profession that's divided about what it is that it means to be a health professional, what the goal is you're after, what the obligations are that go with that role. According to us, and to what we call the provider of services model, not according to us, according to what we call the provider of services model, informed consent, a term that I think everybody can agree with, needs to be kind of expanded to become informed choice. Patients choose reasonably, physicians provide. And a physician may refuse to perform some intervention that's infeasible, that just is not technically possible, or is illegal, or is just unavailable because they don't have the resources nearby. But otherwise, the patient's choices are to be accommodated. According to the provider services model, The central professional standard is put the patient first. Clinicians' personal scruples can't get in the way. I mean, they're fine as far as they go, but they can't get in the way of patients receiving what the patients genuinely believe they need for their well-being. And this idea of patient well-being plays a central role in what we call the provider of services model. Those who criticize conscientious refusals consistently refer to the patient's well-being rather than to the patient's health. Healthcare providers, write Stahl and Emanuel, have a primary interest to promote the well-being of patients. Under the provider services model, medical professionals are providers, and those of you who have been around healthcare professionals, you'll know that that's the language now, the dominant language used to refer to what we might before have called physicians, healers, clinicians, practitioners. They're called providers. They're providers whose goal is to do what is conducive to patients' well-being. And that defines what Stahl and Emanuel call the physician's role morality. That's what you're supposed to do by virtue of putting yourself forward in this role. Adhering to that morality, they add, means offering and providing accepted medical interventions in accordance with patients' reasoned decisions. So, consider these refusals. Suppose you have a gentleman, Mr. Anderson, 50-year-old, with symptoms of bronchitis. Bronchitis just is like when you have a cough. And he requests antibiotics. And his physician refuses to prescribe the antibiotics. That's first case. Second case, Ms. Parker, 21-year-old undergrad here at University of South Carolina, presents to student health and requests a referral for abortion. She's just found out she's pregnant. And her physician refuses to make the referral. So two refusals. And given what I've already said, you might expect that proponents of the provider services model would condemn both of these refusals. After all, Mr. Anderson and Mrs. Parker, or Ms. Parker, both are requesting interventions that are feasible. These are technically possible, that are legal, although I'm just going to assume it's early enough in pregnancy here. I know the laws have been changing, particularly in red states, but if this is an early pregnancy, they're legal, and that are available. And both believe their well-being requires the interventions they request. So Mr. Anderson, he gets that the physician does not recommend antibiotics, but he wants the prescription both to satisfy his wife, who's concerned that he might get worse if he doesn't have antibiotics, and he wants to reduce the however small risk that this is going to develop into a bacterial infection and cause him to miss more days of work. So he says, for me, I need the antibiotic. Ms. Parker understands why many find abortion morally problematic, but she wants the abortion in order to preserve the future that she believes she will lose if she carries the pregnancy to term, right? And that's not hard to understand. She feels like if she carries this pregnancy to term, her life is going to come apart. Despite these similarities, however, only the physician's refusal of Ms. Parker's request typically stirs up folks who are critical of conscientious refusals. How can that be? Let's dig into that a little. So according to what Professor Tolleson and I call the way of medicine, I'm just going to call you Tolleson. Yeah. According to what Tolleson and I call the way of medicine, each of these refusals can be justified insofar as it is grounded in a judgment by the practitioner that what is requested does not serve or indeed is contrary to the end or the goal, the purpose of the patient's health. Where human health is an objective characteristic of the living body. I'll say more about that in a moment. So how does the provider services model distinguish between these two cases and criticize the refusal to refer for abortion, but not criticize the refusal to give an antibiotic? It does so by introducing and leaning heavily on a new distinction. And that is a distinction between refusals that are based on professional reasons and refusals based on personal reasons. And I'll just tell you, to many practitioners, this seems kind of this has a lot of face validity. It seems like refusing antibiotics is a kind of professional refusal. It seems like refusing a referral for abortion is a personal refusal or a refusal for personal reasons. So according to the provider services model, or people who support it. Mr. Anderson's, the refusal of Mr. Anderson's request is defensible because it flows out of one's role morality, like the morality that doctors should only, you know, prescribe antibiotics when they have a scientifically or evidence-based reason to do so. Whereas the physician who refuses the referral for abortion is allowing their personal and private concerns to intrude on or be imposed upon what should be a strictly professional consideration. It's hard to overstate the importance for the provider of services model of the distinction between the personal and the professional. So get ready, those of you going into the healthcare, you're going to hear a lot about the language, you're going to hear a lot of reference to the language of personal and professional and the distinction between them. You won't. You get many philosophical arguments of the distinction between them, because I'll point out it's not well justified philosophically, but you're going to hear that language used a lot. Physicians may believe what they will in their private lives, right? Stahl and Emmanuel, but in their role as healthcare professionals, they must provide the appropriate interventions as specified by the medical profession. And it perhaps goes without saying that judgments of conscience are, according to the provider services model, these are the apotheosis of the personal. To refuse on the basis of conscience is to allow personal biases to interfere with professional obligations, particularly the obligation to respect the patient's autonomy. And it may be difficult, the reasoning goes, but sometimes clinicians have professional obligations to do what their personal conscience may oppose. Yet, even advocates of the provider services model concede that clinicians may refuse patients' requests when they have strong medical reasons to do so, as I just said. So, as was presumably Mr. Anderson's physician did, judging that antibiotics are not medically indicated for a viral infection. So how do clinicians know whether their reasons for their reasons are sufficiently medical? Right? Their patients ask for something, they're thinking, I don't think it's a good idea. How would they know whether they're appealing to a reason that's sufficiently medical? The provider services model fails to provide any non-arbitrary standard to guide such judgments. And that's a problem I'm going to return to in a moment. But critics of conscientious refusals have been clear that medical reasons cannot include traditional norms such as the norm that you should never intentionally damage or destroy the patient's health, or you should never kill. Can't include those norms. Those are personal norms. They're equally clear that that physicians who allow personal concerns to influence their professional practices thereby abuse their power and threaten harm to their patients. So here we see a kind of conceptual novelty of the provider services model. Its standard for harm, when you've harmed a patient, emerges from its standard for benefit, namely patient well-being, subjectively construed. So in the end, if a patient desires something, so if the patient judges that for their idea of what they need for their well-being, this thing is desirable, this thing is necessary, the provider services model calls on the physician to provide what the patient requests, or again, at least refer them to someone who will. Because if you don't do that, you are effectively harming the patient. You are failing to respect the traditional medical principle of non-maleficence, or do no harm. And this position comes with profound political and professional implications. So from the standpoint of social authorities, licensing bodies, lawmakers, the provider services model implies that a physician is obligated via an implicit social contract to provide healthcare services according to the patient's informed choices. The burden of proof then, if you're going to refuse something, the burden of proof is on you, the refuser, to justify how your refusal is not based on merely personal values. American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is the largest professional organization for OBGYNs, proposes further scrutiny to make sure that physicians' refusals are not based on prejudice, and that they're based on what they believe is sound science. So for example, in their view, physicians may not refuse to provide contraceptives based on some concern about preventing implantation of the embryo because, they allege, studies suggest that the incidence of preventing implantation of an embryo is low. There's no need in their mind to consider whether the incidence is low enough to make the moral difference, as long as there's scientific support for treating that incident as trivial. Some proponents of the provider services model will ask policymakers to mandate such scrutiny, to demand alternative service from those who refuse patients' requests. Alternative service being an analogy to those who are drafted, who said they could not serve in the armed forces in good conscience, were required to do alternative service to sort of make their contribution to the war effort. So there, people are saying doctors should be required to do something similar in order to make these refusals costly, like to test them. But it seems that those demands are kind of stopgap measures, at least in the views of many, in anticipation of the desired end, which is that conscientious refusals will no longer trouble patients. They will be eliminated from the professional lives of medical practitioners. A well-known philosopher, Julian Savulescu, put it this way more than a decade ago in an essay that seems increasingly prophetic. He said, if people are not prepared to offer legally permitted, efficient, and beneficial care, again, notice for him, beneficial care is something that fits a patient's control, what their well-being requires. If they're not willing to provide beneficial care to a patient because it conflicts with their values, they should not be doctors. The way of medicine, which is the language we use for that tradition of medicine to which the Hippocratic movement contributed a great deal, that was developed further, particularly in the Christian era and also by Jewish communities, and had substantial contributions from Islamic communities, and has been contributed to further in modernity by the developments, across a number of cultures. That, what I'll call the way of medicine, casts physicians' refusals in a very different light. It asks first whether a refusal is consistent with or contradicts the physician's commitment to the patient's health. Not well-being, subjectively construed, but health. And so then, in that tradition, rather than having a prima facie obligation to provide what a patient seeks, the physician instead has an obligation to pursue what the patient's health requires. Again, well, understanding there are many possible ways of pursuing a patient's health in many cases, and you're only going to do so with the patient's permission, which therefore gives us this longstanding principle of informed consent. The physician refuses to act in ways that are contrary to the patient's health. Such refusals, in the way of medicine, rather than abusing power, properly exercise the physician's authority. Now, note how differently the way of medicine treats the categories of personal and professional. In the provider services model, physicians' professional obligations don't come from inside the practice. They don't from the character of the practice itself, because the provider services model eschews any claim of there being an objective end to medicine. Instead, the professional obligations come from outside. Hence the importance of what's legal, right? If the law allows it, that gives you some obligation. And what's technically possible, right? What do we have the tools to bring about? That gives us an obligation. And then what is desired by the patient? So again, outside of the physician's own judgment and orientation comes the obligation. None of this is intrinsically related to the practice of medicine. There are a lot of things that are legal, technically feasible, and desired by people that have, you know, that can be, including education, that are not intrinsically connected to medicine. Similarly, the provider services model sees the physician's personal commitments as commitments that must be left behind or overcome whenever they conflict with the professional. So then you're going to hear, as you go into healthcare, notions like you need to set aside your personal values when you enter the patient's room, or you can't let the personal trump the professional. And there's a sense that that's what it means to be a professional, is to leave behind your personal values. By contrast, the way of medicine calls on the physician, as a member of the profession, to personally deepen and specify a commitment that the physician already has made personally, long before they embarked on a career in medicine, namely the commitment to attend to those who are sick so as to preserve and restore their health. The way of medicine asks the physician to raise that commitment to the level appropriate to a vocation-defining profession. For practitioners of medicine, then, The central obligation in each of the clinical cases I presented is to act reasonably to preserve and restore the patient's health, whether it's Mr. Anderson or Ms. Parker or anyone else, and to refuse to act otherwise. As we'll see from a slightly more philosophical perspective in a moment, you can only fulfill that obligation if you practice according to conscience. A physician's conscience is clinical judgment in action. It's the capacity used when judging whether an inclination to refuse Mr. Anderson's or Ms. Parker's request is based on good reason, unreasonable desire, or unjustified prejudice. Practicing conscientiously may be difficult, but it can never be reasonable for a clinician to do otherwise. And the way of medicine has implications for those with professional and political authority. It tells them, this is again the leader of some professional organization or the legislator, it tells them that if physicians are to attend to those who are sick using reasonable means to preserve and restore their health, they're going to need some professional space in which to exercise judgment and to practice conscientiously. And although the state has a reasonable ground to hold physicians accountable to general norms of justice, and the licensing and accrediting authorities have grounds to hold physicians accountable to meet their professional obligations, neither the state nor any other authority has grounds to compel physicians to contradict their professional responsibilities. So far, I've tried to show that one's approach to these conscientious refusals turns on how one defines the substance of one's professional commitments and obligations. And throughout the book that we've written together, Tolson and I argue that the way of medicine specifies those commitments, the commitments of healthcare practitioners and their obligations more reasonably. The way of medicine, we think, has additional virtues that the provider service model lacks. And the first one is that it has a better understanding of conscience. So what makes a refusal conscientious? A judgment of conscience is, in the paradigm case, a person's final determination of what is permitted, not permitted, or is obligatory, required, in a particular circumstance. So when you've decided, presumably having other things you could have done at this hour, some of you actually may have had painful things that you didn't do. Like someone said, would you have dinner with me? And you thought, should I have dinner with them or should I go hear that lecture? And you didn't probably deliberate on it too long, but effectively the conscience is called the capacity that you used in judging what was a sensible or right thing to do, all things considered. What faculty is responsible for these judgments of conscience? The traditional view is that of Aquinas. And that is that it is practical reason, which knows the first principles of the moral law, and practical reason, which applies those principles to situations and circumstances so as to lead to particular moral judgments about how one ought to act. So the faculty that's responsible for judgments of conscience, as well as the more general normative judgments presupposed by conscience, is human reason. And there are three points worth noting here. First, conscience judges a person's own actions or motives, not those of others. So when you decide, I think abortion is unethical, that's a judgment of reason. That's not a judgment of conscience. What would be a judgment of conscience would be, I can't do this thing because it seems to cooperate in abortion, which I think is unreasonable. Does that make sense? Conscience judging the quality of your own actions, the actions you foresee or actions you're judging that you've already done. It's not judging making in principle judgments that would cover lots of other people's actions, even as important as those such judgments are. A second thing to note here is that conscience is not a set of considerations that a person might weigh in making a moral judgment. Rather, conscience is exercised in the judgment about how one should act in light of all such considerations. And third, as an act of human reason, conscience is necessarily limited and fallible. So no person sees with absolute clarity. No person judges his or her own actions with perfect accuracy. Conscience is not a portal to God's mind, right? Even if it is a gift of God and part of our nature, that being made in God's image, that we are aware of a moral law and find ourselves judging our own actions. We can get that wrong. And we all we have to do is look at the slides of history, or even of our own lives looking back, to see how we can get it wrong. So conscience, acting conscientiously is, or which is to say, following the judgments of your conscience, is necessary for ethical action, but it's not sufficient. A malformed or misinformed conscience will err, which is why it's important for us to form our consciences according to the truth insofar as we are able. Now, in the end, physicians have to act. And physicians can act ethically only if they act according to their consciences. And errors with respect to conscience obscure this fact. So, for example, according to the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, an appeal to conscience would express a sentiment such as, if I were to do X, I could not live with myself. I would hate myself. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. It's just not the case. Rarely do such emotions characterize conscientious practices. When you decided, some of you, you thought about a couple options and different options for good and decided I'm going to come to this lecture, you probably didn't think something like, if I were to go to that dinner, I would hate myself. If I went and exercised and said I would hate myself, I couldn't sleep at night. No, you just thought, I think this is the more fitting thing to do. So to practice conscientiously is simply to act according to your own best judgment about how you ought to act from situation to situation, patient to patient. Now, others will allege that appeals to conscience are disingenuous and they hide unspoken prejudices. So the concern, for example, for the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology is that when a medical practitioner refuses to cooperate in abortion, they're effectively showing a kind of prejudice against women or a hostility or bigotedness toward those women who find themselves in this situation. Even where agreement exists about the purposes of medicine, physicians still have to consider innumerable factors in order to discern how best to seek the health of particular patients in particular contexts. This is always attended by ambiguity and uncertainty. It requires what Aristotle called phronesis, or practical wisdom, the manifestation of which in the practice of medicine has been called good clinical judgment. And if physicians are to exercise clinical judgment in seeking their patient's health, they'll necessarily refuse some patient requests. So these points that we're making illustrate, we think, that the way of medicine offers a better understanding of conscience. Provider services model asks us to treat conscience not as a faculty of reason, but as a set of idiosyncratic and personal values. Stahl and Emanuel equate conscience with appeal to personal religious or moral beliefs. And if that's the case, if you construe conscience that way, then the physician who acts conscientiously is focused on himself and his own needs rather than on the good and what is required of him. ACOG, American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, similarly associates conscientiousness with a need to be able to sleep at night, as I said, and a defense against personal moral disintegration. Stahl and Emanuel add that physicians' personal commitments cannot outweigh the interests of patients, and they contend that to follow conscience in refusing a patient request violates the central tenet of professional role morality in the field of medicine. The patient comes first. So this way of understanding conscience leads supporters of this kind of provider of services model to make some unsustainable claims. I want to mention one that I think is perhaps the most important one, which is this idea of distinguishing personal conscience from professional conscience, or the notion that physicians should balance one or both, like your personal conscience and your professional conscience, should be balanced against other considerations in deciding what to do in a given case. Some critics will even suggest that a physician occasionally has an obligation to act against conscience. That can only make sense. It can only make sense if the conscience is a set of values, right? If your conscience is a set, effectively, by that you mean a set of values you hold, religious values or otherwise, then it could make sense to weigh up the conscience, this set of values, against other concerns. Or even weigh one conscience, you might call this my personal conscience, my personal values, against another conscience. You might call this a bunch of professional considerations. One might even have reason to act against conscience, right? Because you might say, well, I got these sets of values, but there's some other considerations that trump those, so I'll need to act against conscience. But none of these ways of talking make sense in light of what the conscience is, the faculty of reason that renders a final judgment as regards what one ought to do. Final judgment not meaning correct judgment. If your conscience is working well, you'll make correct judgments generally, but you can err. But final judgment insofar as each of us has to make a judgment about how we're going to act, how we ought to act. And it's that final judgment of all things considered, this is what I ought to do or this is what I cannot do. That's what the conscience is. The conscience is the faculty that makes that judgment. So understood, an individual has only one conscience, and integrity requires that her conscience cannot be split into components. She can't take up the judgment of conscience as one consideration in deciding what she ought to do. It's the final judgment. It makes the final judgment about what she ought to do. Now, you can reconsider an initial judgment in light of new information. We do that all the time, right? Some of you guys were thinking you were going to go have dinner with a friend instead of coming to hear this lecture. And then someone said, did you realize this is Farr Curlin speaking? You thought it was about some philosophical abstruse concept, and then you heard that it's actually about medicine and you're pre-med, let's just say. And now you have new information and you decide, well, in that case, I guess I can skip that dinner with my friends. And that's what all things considered, it's reasonable for me to do so. That's kind of the conscience works all the time. A jury hears the prosecution and may reasonably decide after hearing the case of the prosecution that not this person's pretty clearly guilty. If I were to judge now, I'd say they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And then they hear the defense, they might reasonably change their mind, right, with new information. But what a jury can't do and act as without violating what it means to be a jury is condemn something that someone they think is innocent or exonerate someone they believe is guilty. And effectively, that's what you would do if you acted against conscience. You would do that which you have finally judged, all things considered, you should not do. Or you would refuse to do that which you judged finally you must do. It can't be reasonable to act against conscience. Okay. Another virtue of the way of medicine is that it has a better understanding of professional responsibility. Unless we're going to say that physicians may never refuse anything patients request, and I have not found anyone in the profession, I've been arguing about this issue for 20 years, I've not found anyone who would make that claim. Everybody agrees that doctors have to be able to refuse something. Then we need to have some kind of criteria to judge by which we can distinguish between justified and unjustified refusals. So we need to be able to say, okay, the refusal of Mr. Anderson, was that justified or not? Well, what would be the criteria by which we would judge that's a justified refusal versus an unjustified refusal? As I've noted, the provider services model turns for such criteria to this putative distinction between the personal and the professional. And the problem with this is that the term personal in these debates has no meaning except not professional. If you kind of dig into it, you realize, well, let me just give you an example. If I were to tell you, it cannot be the case that it's a problem to have a personal commitment. Like if I were to say, one of you guys were to say, I want to be a teacher, I want to be a professor. And I say, why? And you say, because I'm personally committed to the pursuit of knowledge. And I'm committed to educating the next generation. If I were to say, well, you can't do that. That would let your personal commitments get in the way of your professional obligations. It would be ridiculous, right? The problem can't be that someone has a personal commitment. So that in these debates, the word personal only functions as a way of saying not professional. And yet, not professional likewise has no meaning or no content unless you can say what is the content of one's professional obligations. So until you can specify what you're obligated to do as a professional, going back to where we started, what goes with putting yourself forward in this role, you can't tell when a refusal is based on something that's not professional or is personal. So in the end, the category of personal distracts from and cloaks the fact that the provider services model cannot say what physician's profession requires beyond accommodating patients' considered, informed requests for legal and technically feasible interventions. without any objective standard to look to, proponents of the provider services model tend to draw these idiosyncratic and arbitrary lines between what they take to be personal and professional. So just to give you a couple examples, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology says physicians must refuse policies that require them to report undocumented patients to immigration authorities because such policies conflict with other professional norms, including the primary principle of non-maleficence. Now, I'll just say I think they have probably a reasonable argument about that. But strange that in the same piece, ACOG takes it for granted that physicians must refer patients for abortion, ignoring altogether the argument that abortion violates the same principle of non-maleficence, right? It's sort of a, you appeal to the principle when it helps you and you ignore it when it seems to contradict you. That's a kind of textbook picture of arbitrariness. Stahl and Emanuel claim that physicians might justifiably refuse assisted suicide, which is a practice that Emanuel, Ezekiel Emanuel, for those of you who don't know, is the principal author of the Affordable Care Act. He was probably the most influential physician in President Obama's administration. He's been a longtime critic of physician-assisted suicide. And so he says doctors can refuse assisted suicide because the practice is currently controversial and subject to debate about whether it is medically appropriate. Okay, I think, so there's a standard. You can refuse something if it's subject to debate about whether it's appropriate. But then he turns around immediately and says that it's impermissible to refuse to refer for abortion or gender affirmation procedures, as if those are not similarly controversial and subject to similar debate. So professional responsibilities, this language, emerges as sufficiently malleable to rule out what a writer dislikes and to require what the writer affirms. In seeking to say more about the professional proponents of the provider services model, will often appeal to straw men to critique moral judgments in medicine. So on the one hand, they'll refer to a standard of care and a consensus as establishing the scope of what physicians must do. And in the next breath, they'll refer to the absence of consensus as the reason physicians cannot justifiably refuse some intervention because many people disagree with the physician's personal opinion. This comes out most strikingly to me in my world in talking about abortion. People will say that you have to refer for abortion because abortion is standard health care. And it's professionally approved by American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the largest organization of people who deal in sexual and reproductive health care. It's also permitted by the American Medical Association. So it's professionally permitted. That's why you must cooperate with it. And then they will say that the reason you can't appeal to the notion that we shouldn't injure the fetus is that people disagree about the fetus. They'll say there's disagreement about the fetus, and therefore, since there's disagreement, you can't object. So you have this, you basically have, if there is disagreement, you can't refuse as long as it's something people want to be provided. And if there is consensus, or if there's some kind of professional organization that affirms something, then you must provide. So you're hemmed in both ways. And in a particularly curious turn, Stahl and Emanuel claim that healthcare professionals voluntarily choose their roles and thus become obligated to provide, perform, and refer patients for interventions according to the standards of the profession. So that's why they say, for example, you must refer for abortion or get out of the profession. And yet, in the same article, they lament that the organizations that most authoritatively establish the standards of the profession all tend to accept rather than question conscientious objections in healthcare. So see the problem here? They're saying if the organizations that set the standards of the profession say something should be done, it must be done. And yet they then turn around and say, and that's why it bothers us that these organizations are allowing for conscientious refusals. If it was true that what the organizations allow sets what should be done, then conscientious refusals are allowable because to this point, they've been allowed by the professional organizations. Okay. ACOG, as well as Stahl and Emanuel, acknowledge deep societal disagreement about whether abortion is permissible, but both claim that abortion is standard medical practice. Although abortion is politically and culturally contested, Stahl and Emanuel write, it's not medically controversial. So again, in this absence of clarity about the professional commitments of medicine, proponents sometimes rely on and sometimes disavow claims of consensus and controversy, adopting a kind of whatever works strategy in an attempt to force their desired shape of conformity onto the profession. The way of medicine, I'm going to close with this, the way of medicine, by contrast, distinguishes not between the professional and the personal, but between that which fulfills the physician's profession and that which departs from or contradicts that profession. And in an important sense, it distinguishes merely between the reasonable and the unreasonable, with attention to the particular vocation of practitioners of medicine. In this way of thinking, the professional obligation to seek the health of patients is to be contrasted not with conscience or with personal obligations, but instead with failures of reason. The solution to failures of reason, because we would acknowledge sometimes people refuse for reasons that are not justifiable. The solution to that is sound exercise of conscience. Let me stop there because I want to leave plenty of time for discussion with you guys. And I'll open it up to any comments or questions you have.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.